This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tom McNeil. Jordanian authorities said that Sunday they foiled a malicious plot by a former crown prince to destabilize the kingdom with foreign support, contradicting the senior royal's claims that he was being punished for speaking out against corruption and incompetence. Faced with rival narratives, the United States and Arab governments quickly sided with Jordan's King Abdullah II, reflecting the country's strategic importance in a turbulent region. Domestically, Prince Hamza's unprecedented criticism of the ruling class without naming the king could lend support to growing complaints about poor governance and human rights abuses in Jordan. At the same time, the king's tough reaction, placing his popular half-brother under house arrest and accusing him of serious crimes, does illustrate the limits on public dissent he is willing to tolerate. The owner of a construction truck that caused Taiwan's worst rail accident in decades, killing at least 48 people, apologized in tears while being led away from his home by police on Sunday. The unmanned truck's emergency brake was not properly engaged, according to the government's Disaster Relief Center. An investigation is underway as to how exactly the vehicle slid down onto tracks Friday from a nearby construction site on the mountainous coast. The truck was hit by a passenger train carrying nearly 500 people, which derailed just before entering the tunnel, crushing many passengers inside the mangled train carriages. This is VOA News. Drug maker Johnson & Johnson says it is taking over a manufacturing facility in the U.S. city of Baltimore after 15 million doses of COVID vaccine were ruined last week. The incident delayed further shipments of the vaccine. The plant is run by the Maryland-based biopharmaceutical firm Emergent BioSolutions, producing both Johnson & Johnson's one-shot vaccine and the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. Johnson & Johnson confirmed workers accidentally mixed up the two vaccine ingredients several weeks ago, spoiling the company's 15 million doses, according to the New York Times. Federal officials attributed the mistake to human error. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is looking into the matter that will delay authorization of the plant's production lines. The containment vaccine doses were expected to be delivered by the end of April to the United States nationwide. However, the incident will delay future shipments of this batch of vaccine in the United States. The error does not affect any of Johnson & Johnson doses that are currently being delivered and used nationwide. All those doses were manufactured in the Netherlands. Everyone in England will be entitled to take a rapid COVID-19 test twice a week to prevent outbreaks and find those people not displaying symptoms under plans to be announced by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson this Monday. Johnson will roll out plans to reopen the economy and eventually relaunch international travel when he updates the coronavirus roadmap. The gradual relaxation of rules will also be aided by the increase in testing availability. As much of Europe enters new lockdowns to tackle surging cases, Johnson will give an update on his staggered plan to ease restrictions in the coming months. Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro announced Sunday that he will extend for the third consecutive week lockdown restrictions to curb the spread of COVID-19 throughout the crisis-stricken South American nation. The additional seven-day extension comes after the country saw an increase of 70% of infections registered in the last 7 days, according to authorities. Maduro indicated that the increase in positive cases is linked to the presence in 13 regions of the country of the new variants, which has its epicenter in Brazil. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's Air Force says the mystery of a missing Alpha jet will soon be resolved.
I believe that in no distant time, the Air Force should be able to unravel the whereabout of the exact spot that the aircraft actually crashed. And by the grace of God, recover our two pilots.
Worrying trend in Benin as that country prepares for presidential election next week. A spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition explains why he defected to the ruling party. The UN says crippling debt keeps developing countries mired in poverty. And Ethiopia says Eritrean troops are withdrawing from Tigray province.
What makes the region stronger is that the conventional war is now over, as the government says, so the presence of Eritrean troops wouldn't be needed as much, I think. So we have to, I think, trust and believe that is happening currently.
Cameroon mourns the death of Christian Cardinal Toumi. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The chief of the Nigerian Air Staff says the crash of the Alpha Jet aircraft that was declared missing on March 31st this year was caused by other factors soon to be determined. Air Marshal Oladayo Amao made the comments during a visit Sunday to the air components of Operation Lafia Dole in Maiduguri. He said the crash of the Alpha Jet should inspire Air Force pilots to remain resolute in the fight against insurgency. Boko Haram has said it shut down the aircraft. Air Commodore Edward Gapkwe is the Director of Public Relations and Information.
First of all, the visit was aimed at being well briefed about the efforts that have so far been made towards finding the crash site of the ill-fated Alpha Jet aircraft. And while there, he received a well-informed brief by the Joint Task Force Commander, Major General Farouk Yahya, on the collaborative efforts between the Army and the Air Force. And he was also briefed by the Air Company Commander of the Joint Task Force, Air Commodore Nnamdi Ananaba. So both of them told him the effort that they have been made. And he also made some inputs. And I believe that in no distant time, the Air Force should be able to unravel the whereabout of the exact spot that the aircraft actually crashed. And by the grace of God, recover our two pilots. And it was also an event for him to boost confidence of our troops and to make them understand that the Nigerian Air Force, the Nigerian Armed Forces, and indeed the entire nation is behind them.
So on the crash of the jet aircraft, you say what's next now is to recover the aircraft itself and to determine what caused it to crash. Is that correct?
Yes, to determine what led to the aircraft disappearing from radar at that point in time on the 31st of March, to locate the crash site, recover the aircraft and the two missing pilots.
What about this video shown on the social media from Boko Haram and that they shut down the aircraft?
I think that in itself has been declared to be a false narrative. We didn't even give credence to that because recall that as soon as that video came out, the Nigerian Air Force released a statement stating that the clips in the video just didn't add up. You can't have that blast of an aircraft as fast as the Alpha Jet and still find most parts of its fuselage intact. And a Swedish journalist, investigative journalist, went a step further, analyzed it, and I don't know which tool he used, and found out that the blast that they were claiming was the blast of the Alpha Jet aircraft was indeed a blast of a helicopter blast that happened in Idlib in Syria.
Yet the military has lost an aircraft. And so the air marshal, what did he say in terms of this engagement that the military is involved in against Boko Haram? How is that going?
The operations are going very, 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 very well. I can assure you on that. The efforts are being sustained. Our troops are undeterred. They are unrelenting. And I can assure you that the fight goes on. The firepower continues. The close air support will go on in support of our troops.
Air Commodore Edward Gapkwe is the Director of Public Relations and Information. The spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, defected to the ruling Patriotic Front Party last week. This as Zambia prepares for presidential election this year. Charles Kakoma had been a member of the UPND for 22 years and 14 of those years as spokesperson for the party. He says he left because he felt the party sidelined him and the people of his northwestern province.
I say that we have differences in approach on how to run the party. We had agreed, if, for example, that in our quest to unite this country, we must have leadership that represents fairly all those language groups and regions in Zambia. And it was agreed that that is the approach to take. But after our national convention, where we are electing leaders, of course, I myself will make the victorious. But in the power sharing arrangement, I found that the region I came from was underrepresented. And I tried to make representations that there must be a fair and equitable representation from all regions, including my own region, where I come from. And that was not done. And therefore, I thought that when disagree with your party or with your leader on a principle, it's better to quit. And I quit.
You mentioned that you had some party elections. Is it true that you left the party because you did not get the post of vice president?
No, that's not true. I was not even in such a position. But obviously, what happened is that even after I won that election at the convention, the president decided to remove me as the party spokesperson. That is the only thing that happened. Of course, for me, I was prepared to serve in any capacity, in any position in the party. But only on condition that there is fair and equitable power sharing among all regions in the country. So I felt that I could not continue to serve the party and the president under such circumstances. That's why I left.
You are from the northwestern province, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So some people say that that's being tribalistic and regionalistic. What's your reaction to that?
No, the issue is that our party has been criticized and labeled for being tribal, in the sense that the region where the party president comes from, in the southern part of the country, they are Tonga-speaking people. So our critics, including the ruling party, were saying this is a Tonga party. And I thought that to be able to remove that tag, we needed to bring in more people from the other regions, including the northwestern region where I come from. So maybe there's a misinterpretation of who I stand, that I'm fostering regionalism. No, I want to unite the country to remove away the tag of tribalism from our party.
That's Charles Kakoma, former spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, for speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 5th. Ethiopia said over the weekend that Eritrean troops have begun retreating from Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. This follows accusations of human rights violations by Eritrean forces in Tigray. The Ethiopian Foreign Ministry said Ethiopian National Defense Force has taken over guarding the national border. The reported withdrawal comes after G7 countries, including the United States, demanded an unconditional and verifiable withdrawal of Eritrean forces. Dr. Masembet Asefa is the assistant professor of law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law. He says the Ethiopian government statement should be considered true because the government has said that conventional war in Tigray has ended.
We have to believe that because Prime Minister Abiy went to Asmara to discuss about these issues, if you remember, just about 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, and the withdrawal issue came in after a consensus proposed by the Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. So you would believe that. I mean, what makes it maybe the reason stronger is that, I mean, the conventional war is now over, as the government says, so the presence of Eritrean troops wouldn't be needed as much, I think. So we have to, I think, trust and believe that is happening currently.
There's some suggestion that Eritrean troops may have gone into Tigray with the full knowledge of the Ethiopian government. What is the government saying?
Yeah, I think there is a level of confusion because for me personally, I also get baffled by the international pressure on Eritrea. If it's about human rights concerns, that's, I think, very correctly noticed. And I think the Ethiopian government has said that any kind of violation of international law principles and humanitarian law principles would have to be addressed. But like I said, I mean, Eritrea and Ethiopia after Abiy Ahmed came in are two friendly states. And Ethiopia actually can invite any, let alone a friendly nation like Eritrea, which has a very strong cultural and historical ties with Ethiopia, even a third-party state, if it wants any support. So I don't understand really the outcry, I think, from the West, to be honest.
There have been two reports in the past week or so, one the CNN and then the BBC, about Ethiopian military massacre in Tigray to the point that they're calling for United Nations involvement. What is the government saying about these reports?
I have read the reports. To be fair, I think one needs to understand that the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, as far as I understand it, has a very good track record in terms of the discipline they show in military operations and engagements and complying with rules of engagement in international law. That's why you see Ethiopia as the largest contributor actually in peacekeeping in many areas, including in the Abyei region in Sudan, and also the deployment in Somalia. The Ethiopia's involvement in peacekeeping goes back during the Congo crisis as well in the back in decades. But like I said, I think there might be instances, and we cannot be definitely sure, that there wouldn't be violations of human rights. Personally, some of the evidences, I think this could be a personal, I think, critique, but the media reporting has been, I think, too much for me. You know, although there are instances and I think the allegations of violations of human rights, you don't find very conclusive evidence on these things. And the reports by CNN and does indicate some level of violence, I think. But I think this needs to be more investigated for me.
Dr. Masembet Asefa is the Assistant Professor of Law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law. He was speaking with us from Addis Ababa. A new study says developing countries will have difficulty recovering from the devastating impact of the COVID-19 pandemic without relief from crushing debt burden that is keeping them mired in poverty. The United Nations Development Program released this study ahead of this week's World Bank International Monetary Fund meetings. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN study finds 120 low- and middle-income economies will owe more than $1 trillion in debt service payments this year. It reports 72 countries classified as vulnerable are responsible for more than half that accumulated debt. UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner says these 72 countries are facing sovereignty or liquidity challenges that will crowd out important socioeconomic expenditures crucial for the well-being of their people.
We need bold new mechanisms. These are urgently needed to help low- and middle-income countries address crippling debt, which has been sharply worsened by COVID-19 and which will prevent vital investments to tackle poverty and climate change for years to come. Investments that we are seeing in a number of wealthier countries now playing out and unfolding. The service of public debt crowds out room for these investments in developing countries.
Steiner says most of the advanced economies are looking forward to a rapid recovery from the pandemic this year. However, the same cannot be said for the poorer countries. He says they are facing increasing poverty as COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc with the physical and economic health of their societies. He says a number of wealthier countries are investing significant amounts of money in stimulus packages to tackle the pandemic and boost their economies. He says similar investments are needed in developing countries, adding they would be transformative. For example, he says funding in Africa could help the continent recover from the pandemic based on green energy technology.
There are, as of this year, still 600 million people on the African continent that have no access to electricity. Nothing would be simpler than to drive a recovery and an energy transition with a significant investment in renewable energy infrastructure, helping to both accelerate development on the African continent and accelerate the transition towards a clean energy infrastructure for what will soon be 2 billion people on the African continent by the middle of this century.
UNDP economists say debt distress and vulnerability do not just threaten the poorest countries. They say middle-income countries and small island states also are buckling under heavy debt burdens. They urge delegates attending next week's World Bank IMF meeting to agree to provide liquidity support to all seriously indebted countries. Given the magnitude of the crisis, they say a combination of debt restructuring, additional financing, and reforms are needed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Cameroonians are mourning the death of Christian Wigan Toumi, a Catholic cardinal who was well known for advocating for peace in the ongoing Anglophone separatist crisis in the country. The 90-year-old cleric was abducted for 24 hours by separatist fighters in November for asking them to disarm. He died on April 3rd. Toumi gained popularity when he advised the long-serving 88-year-old Cameroonian President Paul Biya against running for presidential election, but Biya refused. Mogi Edwin Kinzeka has more from Yaoundé on the legacy of someone that his followers said was a cleric who crusaded for peace and defended human rights.
Je parle à un fonctionnaire au Cameroun. Je suis du Cameroun.
That's the voice of the late Christian Wigan Toumi, broadcast by many local radio and TV stations in Cameroon, including Equinox TV, Royal FM, and Magic FM. The audio comes from a sermon Toumi gave in 2010 while he was Archbishop of Douala. The Roman Catholic Church said Toumi died in the coastal city of Douala on Saturday.
À l'école catholique, on nous a toujours dit, voler, c'est un péché.
In the audio, Toumi says any Christian who has siphoned off state funds should refund the people's money. He says Catholic teachings oppose theft. Those who have stolen government money, he says, must confess and refund the stolen funds if they intend to be accepted into God's heavenly kingdom. Toumi's sermons were broadcast on local stations such as Equinox TV, Royal FM, and Magic FM, and were aimed at rooting out Cameroonian corruption. His message resonated beyond the confines of the church. Musa Umaru is the coordinator of the Council of Imams and Muslim Dignitaries of Cameroon and says Toumi was influential in promoting dialogue between rival religious groups and churches in Cameroon.
Le Sud-Amérique est particulièrement touché par la mort.
Umaru says the council is saddened by the cardinal's death. He calls Toumi an apostle of peace who stood for interreligious dialogue to eliminate tensions between Cameroon's Christian denominations and Muslims. Toumi died when he was 90 years old. He was abducted by Anglophone separatist fighters in Cameroon's crisis-prone northwest region in November and released after 24 hours. Separatists claimed responsibility for the abduction on social media. They said they were angry over the cleric's suggestion that fighters should disarm and work toward a peaceful resolution in the restive western regions. Toumi accused both the military and separatist fighters of human rights abuses against civilians, burning public infrastructure, looting, rape, and sexual violence in the region in media appearances. He also asked the government to withdraw its military from separatist areas and called for a ceasefire to end the separatist crisis. The governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, Deben Chofor, said the cardinal was a peace crusader.
He has been longing for peace, and he was kidnapped when he tried to bring the message of peace to the people. He sent a report to government suggesting that the government should continue to stretch the hand of fellowship to the young who are still in the bush, asking them to come out of the bush and join the other Cameroon to rebuild this nation.
Before Cameroon's October 2018 presidential election, Toumi gave interviews in which he asked long-serving Cameroon President Paul Biya to give up power. Toumi said Biya, who was 86 in 2018, was too old to lead the country successfully. The Biya administration strongly criticized Tumi and called him a controversial religious leader. Andrew Nkea, Archbishop of the Bamenda Archdiocese in the English-speaking Northwest region, said Tumi was a courageous prelate who defended the rights of the marginalized.
We remember Cardinal Tumi as a fearless apostle. He is a man who stood for the truth and was completely unwavering when it came to matters of justice and of truth.
Nkea said Tumi educated hundreds of street children, fed the poor, and provided funds to treat the sick. Tumi was appointed cardinal in 1988 by Pope John Paul II. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Easter Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Istanbul, Turkey, where Kenya's Ruth Chepngetich smashed the women's half marathon world record on Sunday in a time of 1 hour, 4 minutes, 2 seconds. The marathon world champion sliced almost half a minute off the previous best mark of 1 hour, 4 minutes, 31 seconds, set by Ethiopia's Ababel Yeshani in February 2020 in the United Arab Emirates. Ruth Chepngetich was followed across the line in Turkey by Ethiopia's Yelmaziv Yihalo in 1 hour 4 minutes 40 seconds, with Kenya's Heron Obiri third in 1 hour 4 minutes 51 seconds. The 26-year-old is winning the race for a third time after her triumph in 2017 and 2019, where she put clear of Yihalo in the final stages to seal her place in the record books.
Yes, I was confident. Yeah, I enjoyed the race. Though it was tough, but I used my mind to focus for it so that I managed to win.
This was the first time three women have finished inside 65 minutes in one half marathon. World record holder Kipwat Kandi won the men's race in a course record of 59 minutes 35 seconds. And now to weightlifting. 6 countries combined to secure the 12 Olympic berths in men's freestyle that were on the line on the final day of the African and Oceania Olympic qualifier on Sunday. Algeria led the way by capturing 4 quarters, while Egypt, Tunisia and Guinea-Bissau claimed 2 each. Senegal and Nigeria also registered their names by claiming a berth each for the Tokyo Olympics. On Saturday, host Tunisia claimed 4 more places at the Tokyo 2020 Olympics as women's competition took center stage. Nigeria will have at least 4 women also competing in Tokyo after blessing Oborodudu's 68 kilograms gold medal and silver medal finishes from Idris and Aminat Adeniyi at the 50 kilograms and 62 kilograms respectively. In cricket news, South Africa's men national cricket team, the Proteas, claimed a 17-run victory in the second ODI against Pakistan on Sunday. The win ensures South Africa go into Wednesday's climax in Centurion with the series scored at 1-1, and also drew a line under 2 consecutive losses in what is usually a showpiece fixture on the local cricketing calendar. And now to football, where defending champions Al Ahly booked their place in the quarterfinals of this season's CAF Champions League after securing a draw away to El Merrikh in Sudan on Saturday. The Egyptians came from 2 goals down to force a 2-2 draw at the El Merrikh Stadium in Omdurman to secure their place with 1 game to spare. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And that's it for this Monday, April 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.